Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The weather patterns wreaking havoc across the country have decimated lives and livelihoods. Now the torrent of water flowing through the nation's midsection is hitting a new victim, the world's corn supply. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. It is the 9th day of June. Most of us don't particularly enjoy wet weather, but it is far more than an inconvenience in world grain markets. Today, corn futures hit a record high. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says rains and flooding will slash into supplies. It means slightly higher prices at the grocery store here, but real trouble in other parts of the world. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
The USDA report previews supplies of all types of grains. I asked Dr. Joe Glauber, the department's chief economist, for the headline.
The corn market just got tighter.
Now don't get bored. Not yet. Corn supplies matter to nearly everything we eat. And supplies are down, not because we're growing less. Even with the floods, we're on track for record yields. Supplies are down because we're using more to feed our cows and pigs and to fuel our cars.
Corn production has increased over the last few years, but so has demand. Because of that, stock levels have declined.
The feds predict we'll have about 3 weeks of corn on hand.
Essentially scraping the bottom of the barrel at the end of the year.
Randy Mittelstadt is an analyst for R.J. O'Brien, a commodities trading firm. He says he thinks today's record corn prices are reasonable. And he says,
if we have another crop problem like we did last year, the price levels that we're seeing right now, quite frankly, will look very nice 4 or 5 or 6 months down the road.
The U.S. produces about 40% of the world's corn. When the price of corn goes up here, it goes up everywhere, which can be a problem for developing countries.
Most poor people spend large amounts of their budgets on food, in some cases up to 60-70%.
Homi Karas is a researcher at the Brookings Institution. When the prices of food staples jump,
they basically can't afford to buy as much food and they go hungry.
The UN predicts high and volatile food prices into next year. The best hope for food price stability in the short term is something no one can control: good weather. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Today, the German government unveiled a new vision for the country's energy needs. Chancellor Angela Merkel announced last week that nuclear power was no longer an option in the wake of the Fukushima disaster in Japan. Germany is instead going back to the future, with plans to double the number of gas and coal-fired power stations to be built. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
Germany is bowing to the inevitable, claims Dieter Helm, an energy expert at Oxford University. He says if the Germans do abandon nuclear power, they will have to build more fossil fuel plants. Ironic, he says, that this follows pressure from German environmentalists.
What they have succeeded now in doing is pushing Germany to a fossil fuel-dominated system, and they've committed Germany to making a bigger contribution to increasing global warming.
German and other European environmentalists don't agree. Mike Childs of Friends of the Earth says the nuclear power can be replaced with cleaner alternatives.
There are numerous research bodies in Germany who point to the ability of Germany to do much more work on energy efficiency and also an ability to speed up its development of renewable power.
Many energy experts point out that renewables like solar and wind power are intermittent. They depend on whether the sun is shining or the wind is blowing. So you need much more renewable power production capacity. Mark Nichols, editor of Environmental Finance magazine, warns that it will be expensive.
You have to ask what the appetite is for the German taxpayer to foot the bill for such an aggressive expansion of renewables and energy efficiency.
He says because of the cost, financial and climatic, few other countries will turn their backs on nuclear power. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Microsoft is used to duking it out with competitors in court, but a ruling today has to sting. A unanimous U.S. Supreme Court refused to toss out a lower court ruling against the software giant, and that means it has to pay $290 million to a small Canadian company over some features in Microsoft Word. Microsoft argued the patent in question should never have been issued. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich reports.
The software company I4I sued Microsoft in 2007. Microsoft's response was that I4I's patent itself was bad, should never have been issued in the first place, because the technology was already in use. For the Supreme Court, the critical question was how much evidence Microsoft needed to make that case. Megan LaBelle teaches patent law at Catholic University.
What Microsoft was hoping the Supreme Court would do is lower the standard, which would mean that a challenger would only have to prove that it was more likely than not that the patent was invalid.
The court said no, only Congress can lower that standard. Now, Microsoft was cast in its familiar role as the technology-stealing heavy, but LaBelle says the case highlights a real problem.
When you have rules like this that discourage parties from challenging potentially invalid patents, that means that consumers pay higher prices because the patent owner has a monopoly on that invention for a limited amount of time.
An invalid patent unfairly limits access to technology, and mistakes do happen. Patent attorney Peter Zura says the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is underfunded and overloaded.
There's only so much that they can look at one time. And now it's not just the U.S. companies that are filing. You got all these Chinese companies coming in, Japanese companies, European, you know, everybody's got the filing bug.
Updating the rules to undo a bad patent is one measure lawmakers could address in the patent reform bill now in Congress. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a break in the losing streak. We'll have details when we do the numbers. This week, we've been looking at China's higher education system, what it takes to get into college, and what happens once students get there. China's emphasis on taking tests to get ahead in society raises questions about whether those students will be creative enough to thrive in an economy based on innovation. One school in Beijing is trying to get away from the testing culture. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has the final of three reports.
Peking University High School's answer to China's outdated rote learning-based education system is here in an empty classroom on the second floor. Instead of neatly arranged desks and red propaganda banners hanging above the chalkboard, there's a drum set, an electric guitar, and a mic stand. Here, says Deputy Principal Zhang Shuiqin, is where students come to rock.
They just start the rock band. To be perfectly honest with you, I've heard them. They're not very good, but it's something that they love doing. It's fun for them.
This wasn't really what Chairman Mao Zedong had in mind when he and party cadres set up China's modern education system in the 1950s, but that's the point. Peking University High School, one of China's premier schools, is under new management.
We encourage students to express themselves as much as possible through artwork, through music, through writing. It's just that because students have been through this traditional system, they have problems doing that.
Consider it therapy for students who spend most of their high school years preparing for one single test, the National College Entrance Exam, known in Chinese as the Gaokao. Principal Wang Zheng says the system is flawed.
Schools in China spend so much time preparing students for the Gaokao that they ignore every other aspect of education in the process. This means that by the time students get to university, they're not able to develop themselves.
So Wang's been chosen to shake up Peking University High School. The school's connected to Peking University, considered the Harvard of China. That's made it all the more controversial that it hired a principal bent on radical reform. The first thing Principal Wang did when he arrived at the school was to have all the lecterns ripped out of the classrooms. Chinese teachers typically stand behind them to deliver the day's lesson. Wang asked his teachers to start moving among their students, engaging them, not talking at them. And that's what chemistry teacher Qin Lei is doing today. Instead of asking students for the correct answers, Qin focuses on the process, asking students their opinions, asking why, how, challenging what they know. That teaching method is routine in the West, but in China, it's a radical departure. Principal Wang made a name for himself at Shenzhen High School in the southern province of Guangdong when he gutted the school's curriculum and let students choose their own classes.
A lot of educators from all over the country visited our school. They all agreed the system was good, but risky.
Risky paid off. Wang removed the focus on the Gaokao, yet students improved their scores. Now, nearly a fifth of the students Guangdong province sends to China's top two universities come from Wang's old school. He hopes to work the same magic in Beijing, but not everyone's on board.
As a parent, I have a difficult time with some of the changes. I don't think they're suitable.
Go Qingli's son attends the school.
My son is spending less time studying for the Gaokao than students at other schools. I just don't think it's enough, and I'm scared it'll impact his scores.
I only have one child, Go says. Principal Wang says he understands the pressure.
This new system tends to polarize the students. Those with a lot of potential do better than before, but those without it tend to fail. But I think it's good preparation for the real world.
For 16-year-old Li Keying, who sings in the school's rock band in her spare time, the changes have meant more work, not less, and more responsibility.
We may have more free time than students at other schools, but that means we have to carefully manage it. Nobody is holding our hands, telling us where to go next.
But Li is lucky. Her parents are professionals, and she attends an elite school. Principal Wang says it'll be hard to carry out the same reforms in the hundreds of thousands of schools across China, many in poor rural areas. 1,400 years of tradition, he says, is difficult to change in just one lifetime. In Beijing, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
And you can find out more about China's education system on Rob's Chinopoly blog at marketplace.org. Kai is in China, too, dodging traffic. Find out more on his blog, also on our website. This weekend's big summer blockbuster wannabe is Super 8. If you're unclear as to what the movie is about, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. Big secret. Something about kids and aliens. Got to go to the Cineplex to find out the rest. But there's another genre of pictures that has commentator Dana Stevens asking, where, oh, where have you gone?
It's become a critical truism to say that the romantic comedy is in decline. The genre that gave us Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn in Bringing Up Baby, William Powell and Myrna Loy in the Thin Man movies, Woody Allen and Diane Keaton in Annie Hall, and John Cusack and Ione Skye in Say Anything, has been reduced to pairing up Katherine Hagel and Gerard Butler in The Ugly Truth, or Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston in Just Go With It. That isn't meant as a slight toward contemporary actors. With the miserable vehicles they're trapped in, how do we even know what our modern-day comedians and comedians are capable of? Most Hollywood romantic comedies now seem to come in two flavors. There are those so enervated and bland they seem to have been boiled dry of any real conflict or substance. Those are the ones marketed at women. Then there are those so crassly sexist they make you despair not only for the future of cinema, but the future of the human race. Yes, those are the ones marketed at men. Many reasons have been adduced for this decline. Changing social mores have decodified the rituals of courtship, removing many of the obstacles that traditionally kept the lead couple apart until the final frame. Then there's the new economics of Hollywood. Movies can no longer afford to be modest successes. They must win the weekend and reap vast global profits to be worth making at all. Dialogue-driven, special-effects-free rom-coms, however charming they may be, don't have the international theater-packing power of a Pirates of the Caribbean. But just as happens with romantic love in real life, our hopes for the romantic comedy somehow keep springing back unabated after every soul-grinding disappointment. Later this summer, Julia Roberts and Tom Hanks will appear together in Larry Crown. Hanks directed the film about a man laid off from his job who goes back to night school and falls for his teacher. Hanks and Roberts are both veterans of the era when romantic comedy still occasionally contained both romance and comedy. Here's hoping, against hope, that their new film recaptures a little of that old screwball charm.
Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate and the co-host of their Cultural Gabfest podcast. Got your own take? Send them in. Marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Coming up, help is on the way for frustrated homeowners who are hoping to reduce their mortgages and avoid foreclosure.
I'm in an interest-only loan as of now, and we are just renting, paying just like a rent.
But first, let's do the numbers. Record U.S. exports in April led to a bounce back in the markets. After six straight losing sessions, the Dow rose 75 points, 0.6% to finish at 12,124. The Nasdaq gained 9 points, 0.3% to wrap at 2684. The S&P 500 also put on 9 points, 0.7% to close at 1289. Most of the gains came in the final half hour of trading. The price of oil reached nearly $102 per barrel, pumping up energy stocks. Chevron and ConocoPhillips each climbed more than 1.25%. ExxonMobil gushed up 0.5%. Deere and Company drove up 2.5%. DuPont engineered a 1.5% gain. Caterpillar scooped up 1.25%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for May. Alcoholics Anonymous marks its 76th anniversary. And we followed her on the Yellow Brick Road. Dorothy Gale is just one of many parts singer and actress Judy Garland portrayed during her lifetime. She was born on June 10, 1922. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. The Great Recession spawned an entire cottage industry of books, movies, even songs, all trying to figure out how it happened, why it happened, who's responsible. For Brooklyn-based artist Robin Hasty, the more interesting question is what happens after crisis, how people change the way they live. For the past 7 months, Hasty has been crisscrossing the country, taking images for a photo series she calls Homeland. Her photo technique goes back 150 years. It's called Wet Plate. You can see her work in an audio slideshow on our website. At her recent stop in Los Angeles, we caught up with her to learn more about the project.
It is a cross-country photo essay about people that are engaging with the economic collapse, engaging with systems that are failing. I feel like certain cities embody this very well, and that's one of the interests for doing it across the country. Austin, the people I photographed there, Boggy Creek Farm is the name of the place. I was interested in them because they've been doing urban organic farming for about 25 years, and they're an older generation of people, so they reflect a side of this that goes beyond the most recent economic collapse, that there is a long history of cycles of collapse and renewal. I've been doing art for my entire life, I had this moment where I was like, where am I going with my art and my development? And I took a workshop on wet plate, and I was like, oh, I know exactly what I would do with this process. Wet plate is a photographic process that was invented in 1851. It is a chemical process. Basically, you are making an emulsion on a either metal or glass, and the detail is incredible, so much sharper than anything a 35 millimeter could produce. I did one loop from New York to New Orleans, through Austin, Dallas, Little Rock, Arkansas, Asheville. Yesterday, I shot in Venice. If you actually sit out there with the guys that are out playing bongos for money, you realize that, like, functioning or not, the economic world is affecting everybody. And I guess the will of the individual, even in certain circumstances that are very extreme, to still have this energetic, active, creative energy. And so, like, that was really important.
Artist Robin Hasty.
Today, the Obama administration cut off three of the nation's largest banks from federal money intended to help with foreclosure relief. The Treasury Department said JPMorgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Bank of America aren't doing enough to help troubled property owners under the Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP. 3 years after the financial collapse, there is no end to the foreclosure crisis. So one nonprofit is traveling the country holding what are essentially loan modification conventions. Show up with all your paperwork, they put you with a counselor, and then face-to-face with a bank representative.
Juan Hernandez.
Christina Hoffman.
Some 5,000 people a day filed through L.A.'s Shrine Expo Center over 5 days last weekend. It's called the Save the Dream Tour, organized by the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, or NACA. Homeowners lined up for blocks, some camped out overnight. Inside, we met Sean Ricks, one of the NACA housing counselors, and Vahe Azarian, a computer technician looking to refinance the mortgage on a house he and his wife bought 8 years ago.
I'm in an interest-only loan as of now, and we are just renting, paying just like a rent.
What did the bank tell you when they decided not to modify your loan on their own?
They come up with kind of excuses that they said, I mean, your loan is with us, but since it wasn't Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac or whatever, we cannot do anything at this point. And the interest rate's so high, it was killing us.
Sean, is any of this difficulty because he doesn't have 20% value in his house?
I really don't understand why the banks do that. To me, if your homeowner comes and he's struggling and you can help him, why not?
What's it like to have all these people coming through? I mean, it's a stunning number of people who are in need of help.
I was really totally surprised that we were still at this number here in L.A. because this is our fourth trip here. I would say that we need to come back again.
Bruce Marks is the CEO of NACA.
Every person who's here has already tried and failed to work with their lender. So it's really incumbent upon the government to require them to do it. I used to be a regulator. I worked at the Federal Reserve Bank. The fact of the matter is, as a regulator, they can force these lenders to do it across the board.
Why does it take something like this for a homeowner to be able to modify a loan? What's the difference here?
There are two differences. We have legally binding agreements with all the major lenders and the investors covering over 90% of the mortgages in this country where they have to do it. Secondly, there's nothing like that face-to-face interaction. Personal interaction is what gets the results because you see families, you see the devastation firsthand, and that makes that banker that much more committed to helping the homeowner.
But if that's the case, then isn't it pretty close to impossible for banks to do this for the millions of people who need a loan modification?
Well, actually they can. But you know, you have to have the government pushing to do that. I mean, the biggest problem we have are not with Bank of America mortgages or Chase or Wells or Citi. It's with government-owned mortgages, FHA, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. So the mortgages that the government controls, those should be the ones that we can modify the easiest. They should stop the foreclosures, and they should say that these bankers can never foreclose on somebody unless every effort was made to modify that mortgage and that was documented.
What just happened there? We just heard some applause in the background.
That is another solution, someone saving hundreds of dollars, maybe over $1,000 a month in a mortgage payment.
Success story.
Yes, it is a success story. I mean, I have the best job in the country. I mean, people come up to me, I mean, sometimes big men just bawling with tears streaming down their face because they said, you know, now I can go home and I can look my children in the eyes and I can sleep at night. And I haven't slept at night for maybe 1 or 2 years.
Are there situations here where you simply look at the paperwork and have to tell the homeowner, look, you need to give up the house?
There's no 100% in life. But if you can help 80, 90% or more, then obviously that's a great success.
Are we going to see you back here in a year?
I hope not. We will do whatever we take for as long as it takes to help the homeowners out there until we are put out of business because the banks are doing it and the government's doing it.
Bruce Marks, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, a farewell to one of the creators of an activity that got us through many a road trip as kids. Writer and producer Leonard Stern died on Tuesday. He was 88. Mr. Stern's credits include The Honeymooners and Get Smart. He was also a co-creator of Mad Libs. To date, more than 110 million volumes of the fill-in-the-blank game have been sold. And so, in his honor, from the first ever book of Mad Libs by Leonard Stern and Roger Price, and the minds of our Marketplace colleagues, a good wine served
painfully
can make any meal a truly
juicy
occasion. The red wines have a
futzy
flavor that blends with boiled
balloons
or smoked
donkeys.
White wines range in flavor from
green
to
bewildered.
The best wines are made by peasants in
Indiana
from the juice of ripe
tote bags
by putting them in vats and squashing them with their
delicious
feet. This is what gives wine that
peripatetic
aroma. Okay. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow put on 75 points, 0.6%. The Nasdaq gained 9 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 tacked on 9 points, 0.7%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, from magazine editors to graphic designers, the bicycle is back in fashion.
It speaks to our customer because our customer is young at heart.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.